confess that Jesus Christ is Lord to the glory of the Father.
Can't say it better than that. Mm-hmm.
So good.
So good. All right. So, let me give you a little bit of background as we've been working our way through this chapter, through these chapters here. As we've said that that every chapter moves us along in time. And that's what happens here, that there's 20 years, about 20 years between chapter 4 and now in chapter 5. And they've been, historians, ancient historians, tell us that it's a very tumultuous 20 years. Let me see if I can do out a little bit of a sketch here. So we've got King Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4. All right. And he reigned for about 45 years as king. And then historians told us that he died. And one of his sons reigned in as the next king. Let me see if I can draw this out here. His name is Merodach. And he reigned for about 2 years. And he was a son of King Nebuchadnezzar. But King Nebuchadnezzar also had a daughter. And her husband's name was Nergal-Sharezer. And he had Merodach assassinated. So really good family dynamics. All right. And he died soon after that. And their son, Lab-Ashi-Marduk, what are these names? All right. Nergal-Sharezer, he reigned for about 6 years. And then their son took over, and he reigned as king only for a few months because another daughter of King Nebuchadnezzar she married a guy by the name of Nabonidus. And Nabonidus had Lab-Ashi-Marduk assassinated. So really good family dynamics, you know, kind of family you really are glad you're born into, right? So Nabonidus had Lab-Ashi-Marduk, and then what happened is for the next 10 years, he was away on military campaigns. You know, he said this is the empire, the Babylonian Empire, and they're constantly not only trying to expand it, but try to hold on to it. And so they're in conflict with the Egyptians and, you know, the Medes and the Persians and all these other, you know, empires around here. So he's gone for next 10 years. Probably, you know, maybe he didn't want another daughter's husband to assassinate him or something like that. But so what he does is he puts his son, Belshazzar, in place as being the king in residence. So he's the number two co-regent, co-king in a sense. And that's who we see here in chapter 5, is King Belshazzar. He's actually the king's son. And he is, while his father, the true king at this point, is away on for 10 years on these military campaigns, and Belshazzar is the king in residence. And so he's the number two king. And we'll see how that shows up here a little bit later on as we start into chapter 5. So can someone read for us verses 1 through 12? Anybody? Go ahead.
King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. While Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem, so that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. So they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles and his wives and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. His face turned pale, and he was so frightened that his knees knocked together and his legs gave way. The king called out for enchanters, astrologers, and diviners to be brought and said to these men, wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain around his neck, and he will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then all the king's wise men came in, but they could not read the writing or tell the king what it meant. So King Belshazzar became even more terrified, and his face grew more pale. His nobles were baffled. The queen, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles, came into the banquet hall. O king, live forever, she said. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There is a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, he was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. King Nebuchadnezzar, your father the king, I say, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. This man, Daniel, whom the king called Belshazzar, was found to have been a keen mind and knowledge and understanding, and also the ability to interpret dreams, explain riddles, and solve difficult problems. Call for Daniel, and he will tell you what the right means.
Thank you. All right. So it uses the word father throughout this chapter here, and this is written in Aramaic. And the word father in Aramaic can refer to any male in your lineage. So it could be the same word is used for your biological father, for your grandfather, for your great-grandfather, anyone in the male lineage of your family, it uses the word father. So Belshazzar's father is Nabonidus, who's gone away. But his father also is King Nebuchadnezzar, because he's the grandson of King Nebuchadnezzar. And it could have been used for whoever in his male lineage. So we see this word used throughout here. And it just means someone that's in your lineage as your as a male comes before you. Historians also tell us at the time, and we'll see a little bit of this at the very end of this chapter here, that while Nabonidus is away on his military campaigns, there's a rising empire to the east of them, more along the lines of Iran today, the Medes and the Persians. They come and lay siege to the city. And so at this point in time, we see Belshazzar, he's throwing a great feast for 1,000 of his lords, and they're drinking wine in front of the 1,000. And all the time, all the while, the Medes and the Persians are at the gate. They've surrounded the city. They've laid siege to the city. But they're not really concerned about it, because history tells us that the city at this point was a great city. It had this wall that surrounded the city. It was such a big and high and wide wall that they could run chariots on the top of it, side by side. They could pass. So this wall is really wide. It's really tall. It's really heavy. It's thought to be impregnable, that it can't be assaulted. And it had lasted for 1,000 years, this city like this. And so this, you know, was not much of a concern that here's this foreign army that comes and besieges them, because they had enough stores stocked up, enough food and supplies, that they could outlast any siege. I mean, you have a big army that comes against you, they've got to have supply lines. You know, and it's desert in this part. We're talking Iraq at this point. And they've got to have supply lines to bring in all the foodstuffs to handle all the livestock, the horses, the, you know, the soldiers, everything. And this city says, hey, we can outlast them. And we've got this wall that they can't be beat. The city was built over the river, the Tigris and Euphrates River. And the river ran right underneath the walls. And so they had all the fresh water they wanted. because there's a big city at this point in time. A lot of people. It's one of the most magnificent cities built at this time. And they had fresh water. And they had all the food and stuff that they needed stored up. So no worries that they've been besieged. Maybe they sent away, you know, for Nabonidus to come back with his army. We're not told that, but they're not worried. And so we see here that King Belshazzar, he throws this big party. And it gets the attention of the Lord. He wasn't invited as one of on the guest list. And we see that there's 1,000 of the nobles, and they're having a fabulous time with all the wine and the drink and the entertainment, and there's probably a lot of stories being told. There's a lot of great things happening here at this. Probably these 100 or these 1,000 nobles are thinking pretty good about themselves. Like, hey, we made the cut. We made the list. We've been brought in. You know, we're part of the elite of the city. You know, we've been invited to party with the king. That's pretty cool. And so we get this setting, and things are about to change pretty dramatically. What's happening here? What are the actions and the attitudes on the part of Belshazzar's and his guests that would have provoked the Lord's anger against them? What's happening that catches the Lord's attention and provokes his anger? What's the attitudes and the actions?
You see the goblets and cups from the temple, mm-hmm. and then not only defiling those, but giving praise to the gods of gold or stone, wood, whatever. So taking all the glory from God, abusing his instruments of worship. I think that really, you know, there are a handful of things God really tells you, don't do this. And this is one of them.
Yeah, back in chapter 1, we saw that when King Nebuchadnezzar overran Jerusalem, not only did he deport the nobles and their children and that, but he also took the temple objects that were used to worship God, to give glory to God, to honor God, and brought that back to Babylon and put them in storage. And so now we see that Belshazzar takes them out of storage, and he is in his party. You know, he's using the objects that were reserved for the worship of God, and he's telling stories, obviously, and he's doing a lot here, and he gives praise to all these gods of wood and stone and gold and silver and all that, which were the gods of Babylon, and this great and magnificent city, all the things. Remember King Nebuchadnezzar standing out on his rooftop thinking, look at this fabulous city that, you know, we've built, or I've built. And he looks at all the gold and the silver and the gardens and everything in that. And so here's Belshazzar, you know, taking note of all of that. And he's also giving praise and glory to all the gods and using the temple, Jerusalem temple objects, to do that. Anything else you'd add into that? Any attitudes or actions?
Pride,
definitely.
Yeah. I'm going to do what I want to do with no regard to a sovereign, most high God.
Yeah. We don't see that even out of Nebuchadnezzar. You know, he leaves them in storage. We don't even see that. Belshazzar has taken the next step beyond that. More.
His brother's warning in Exodus says, have no other gods before me. And a lot of bad things will happen if you do.
Yeah.
So it's very clear.
Definitely. A verse that comes to my mind is Proverbs 21:24. I can read it for you. Not Proverbs 12, Proverbs 21. Scoffer is the name of the arrogant, haughty man who acts with arrogant pride. Scoffer. I get a sense of that's what's happening here, is Belshazzar in his big party with all the important people there, he's scoffing God. He's demonstrating his arrogant pride. Look at the gods of Babylon has overtaken Jerusalem. Look, we've got their temple objects. I'm going to have my concubines drink out of this. You know, it's just like the story today in the service, you know, of the Ark of the Covenant put before Dagon, the god, you know, the Philistines. Same kind of thing here, is that we're going to take these temple objects that are used to give glory and honor and praise and worship to God, and we're going to have, you know, the Babylonian gods and the concubines, and we're going to scoff God. We've overrun Jerusalem. They're nothing. And that gets God's attention in a big way. We saw Nebuchadnezzar have pride in himself. Look at all that I've accomplished. But we see now that Belshazzar's taken it even further. Now he's scoffing God. What do you think motivated Belshazzar to do that?
Do you think he was aware of what happened to his grandfather? Or was he so far removed that that wasn't a lesson to him? Or was he thumbing his nose at that whole lesson?
Well, we're going to read that part. Oh. So I'm not going to answer that question, but it's a very, very right-on question. So we're going to read that in a moment here. What do you think motivated him?
He may have been a little drunk and makes you just do things that maybe you wouldn't normally.
Yeah, he's definitely reveling in the party atmosphere. Yeah. Can you imagine? Here's a party for 1,000 people. You know, think of the biggest wedding reception you've probably ever been to. Probably never, I don't know, maybe you've been to 1,000. You know, I've been to one about 500. That's a pretty big deal. But I get the impression here that he's, you know, the center of attention. He's got 1,000 people, all the important people in Babylon are here. And, you know, he's going to just revel in this. And he's going to get a little buzz from the wine and the environment and everything, and he's just going to scoff all the accomplishments, you know, of the Babylonian Empire, you know, overrunning all these other kingdoms. His father, the true king, is outdoing more of it. And the Medes and the Persians are at the door. They've surrounded the city. And he's sitting there with all these temple objects, and he's scoffing the gods of Jerusalem, of Judea, of Daniel and his friends, the Jewish true God. And he's having a grand old time.
And
he's showing off.
He's showing off. He's showing off with total disregard. I mean, that's a catchphrase, but he's a show off.
Mm-hmm.
Scoffers are show offs.
So last time, last chapter, we saw that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream that really bothered him. It perturbed him. It unnerved him. And Daniel came and gave him a warning. And we saw that it took a year before the Lord acted on it. We don't get a year here. We get immediate. The Lord says, you're going to mock. You're going to use the temple idols, items, you know, and give glory to those idols using the temple objects. You're not getting a year. You're getting an immediate response. God is not mocked. God is not scoffed. And so what happens? A hand appears. A heavenly hand appears. And what's the response of Belshazzar? I think it's humorous at this point. Fear. His knees are knocking. He's pale, and he gets even paler. You know, this has got it. You know, he's maybe the first time he's a little buzzed, and he's thinking, you know, am I just seeing things because I'm, you know, I'm a little tipsy. But, you know, and you can imagine the hush on the whole crowd, 1,000 people, all the noise and the reveling and everything. That room is silent at this point. And this hand appears, and they are freaked out by it. And so what does he do? He calls his astrologers, the Chaldeans, the magician. You think they would have learned after, you know, 60 years that these guys aren't going to do anything. But this is certainly an unnatural event. So who else can you call? You got to call the guys. Maybe they'll get it right. The choir got out. See, I told you. And maybe these guys, because there's nobody else is going to do this. So they call these guys in, and what do? They don't do anything. They've learned at least a little bit of, you know, we can't offer up anything. We better not offer anything, because every time we do, we get beat down. But they're confused as much as Belshazzar and the other 1,000 people there. And they don't know what's going on. And everybody's alarmed. And everybody's perplexed. And they don't know what's happening. But there is one person that knows what to do. Who is that? Before that.
No, he's pointed to Daniel by the queen, yeah.
So Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, you know, Nabonidus' wife, Belshazzar's mother, the queen, says, hey, these jokers that you try to, you know, get to explain this, she comes along and says, you know, you need to consult not these guys, but Daniel. Okay, can someone pick up for us and read 13 to 31? Anybody? I don't think there's any hard names. Okay, go ahead, finish it off.
So Daniel's brought before the king. Said to him, are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father and the king brought from Judah? I have heard that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that you have insight, intelligence, and outstanding wisdom. The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it means, but they could not explain it. Now I have heard that you are able to give interpretations and to solve difficult problems. If you can read this writing and tell me what it means, you will be clothed in purple and have a gold chain placed around your neck, and you will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Then Daniel answered the king, you may keep your gifts for yourself and give your reward to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read your writings for the king and tell him what it means. How far do you want me to read?
All the way to the end, please.
Okay. O King, the Most High God gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. Because of the high position he gave him, all the peoples and nations and men of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. Those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hard, hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and sets over them anyone he wishes. But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you have set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You have the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drank wine from them. You praise the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all your ways. Therefore, he sent the hand that wrote the inscription. This is the inscription that was written. Mina Tekel Harsin?
Close enough.
Okay. These are what these words mean. Mina, God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel, am I saying that right? Tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Perez?
Close enough.
It says Perez in my book. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple. A gold chain was placed around his neck, and he was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62.
Thank you very much. That's a lot of reading. All right. So the queen, Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, wife of Nabonidus, king number one, mother of Belshazzar, queen, king number two, she comes to Belshazzar and said, hey, there is some guy that can answer these things. You know, Daniel's reputation. Belshazzar should have consulted him right away. But no, he goes to all these other guys. But the queen reminds him or tells him about Daniel and gives him an assessment, a pretty amazing assessment, of his abilities and of his character. She says that he's able to interpret dreams, to explain riddles and solve problems. So Belshazzar, hey, this is a pretty amazing time. A heavenly hand writing on the wall comes, and he says, if this guy can do it, my mother says he can do it, it must be true. So they call Daniel. In verse 13, we see that Daniel was brought before the king, and the king says to Daniel, okay, you're one of the exiles of Judah who my father, King Nebuchadnezzar, so his grandfather, brought from the land of Judah, and that been made attention, brought to my attention that you're able to make sense of all of this, and that the wise men, the enchanters, they can't make sense of it all. Daniel's thinking probably, duh. that's in the margin. We've seen this for how many years now? Probably about 50 years. They're not going to be any help. And so Belshazzar says, okay, if you can do this, I'll give you a lot of rewards. I'll make you the third king. Nabonidus is king number one. He's number two. Belshazzar is going to make Daniel number three, the third kingdom, the third king of the whole Babylonian Empire. Isn't that amazing? Here's this kid, back in chapter 1, 15, 16, 17, 18. Now, as a 7-year-old man, is going to rise to number 3 of the whole empire. Not just the city of Babylon, but the whole empire. God has done a pretty amazing thing here in Daniel's life to bring him to this point. And even Belshazzar recognizes that he's an exile, a Judah, and brought here. He says, but if you can do this, I'm going to make you the third kingdom, the third ruler in the kingdom. Verse 17 then, Daniel answers and said to the king, what does he tell him? How does he reply to the king?
Give it freely.
Oh yeah, keep your stuff. Yeah, keep your stuff. I'm going to give it to you anyway, free. I don't need all this. I don't need gold chains and purple robes and all these things. We've seen every time with Nebuchadnezzar, and now we're seeing it again with Belshazzar, that Daniel doesn't just say, okay, here's the answer. He always prefaces it with giving God the glory, God the praise, God the honor, that I can't do this in and of myself. This isn't because I'm extra smart. I took an extra class at the University of Babylon, that gave me, insights into all this. Is that he prefaces it with saying, okay, the only way I can do this is because it's been revealed to me by the Most High God. The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your father, kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. And it's because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would have killed and whom he would. He kept alive and whom he raised up. So he gives glory and honor. So here's another opportunity that Daniel takes to basically witness to the true God before the number two person in the whole kingdom. What a ministry that he's had over all these years and everything. And I'm sure he's not standing in a room by himself. He's here with 1,000 people. The enchanters and the magicians and the astrologers and the Chaldeans, they're all around him. And they're thinking, oh, here it goes again. Daniel, we just don't want him here. We've heard the stories. We've seen him in action. Why does he keep showing up? But he gives glory and honor. In verses 22 and 23, I think, are the key verses of this chapter, of chapter 5 here. Notice, I want to read these two verses again to you today, here. But notice that 15 times in these two verses, the pronouns you or your or yourself show up. And you, his son, Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. So here's the answer to your question. You know, you knew all this. But you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven, and the vessels of his house have been brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see or hear or know, but the Lord, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and whose are all your ways, you have not honored. Woo. Can't you just see the wagging finger or the pointing finger or something? Or the emphasis in his voice? It's you, 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 all the way along here. He could have just answered and said, here, I'll tell you the answer to this. But he's got the king's attention. He's got 1,000 people paying attention to him. And he gives him a pretty hard indictment. You knew all this. This is what you did. Whoa. Now, if this was Nebuchadnezzar, he might have gone off on a tirade and, you know, off with his head type thing. When we did see that, though, Nebuchadnezzar, it took a long time, years, for him to respond rightly. But with Belshazzar, because he's gone beyond just pride in himself, he's mocked God, he scoffed at God, he doesn't get the same length of time. And Daniel points that out to him very pointedly by saying, you, you, you. I think it's probably the key thing here. So we see these three words. And they can't figure out what is the significance of these three words. They probably knew the word. It's not, you know, unknown to them. But Daniel here digs into the lexicon and gives the interpretation that explains out why these three words. To them, it's very cryptic. Mene comes from the verb to number or to reckon. Tekel comes from the verb to weigh. And eupharsin comes from the verb, or it says, what's the other word? Perez comes from the word to break in two or to divide. And then he explains it. He says, you know, he tells what those things are. That God has numbered your days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. All right. So this Belshazzar gets exactly what he asked for. He wants to be told the significance of this heavenly hand writing on the wall. You know, I think this is where the English idiom comes, you know, the handwriting on the wall comes from this account. It's been said that maybe this was even behind the Facebook term, writing on your wall, your Facebook wall. I know Facebook doesn't use that as much anymore. But so this has worked its way into our English language quite a lot. So Daniel comes and he gives Belshazzar exactly what he wants in the midst of this big party with 1,000 of the important people there. And, you know, the wise men are in attendance, and he's able to explain out these words and what they mean. And he pointedly talks to Belshazzar why this heavenly hand has been sent. That your kingdom has been weighed and numbered, and it's going to be brought to an end. The balances, and you've been found wanting, and it's going to be, your kingdom's going to be divided and given up to the Medes and the Persians. Oh yeah, those are the guys right outside the door, outside the wall. These are the guys that are surrounding us. It's not going to be 12 months. It's not going to be 7 years like what you knew about your grandfather, your father, grandfather, King Nebuchadnezzar. It's going to happen now. So how does Belshazzar respond? What's it say?
He does put the chain around his neck and the robe on him.
Yeah.
But then he doesn't have much more of a reign left in him.
Uh-huh. He made him number 3, but the next day he was number 2.
Yeah. Definitely.
So he didn't seem very concerned about it. Maybe he didn't believe what Daniel told him. I don't know.
Yeah.
Of course, if he didn't believe him, why would he make him number 3?
Yeah.
I like what Daniel said to him. That you have not honored the God who gives you the breath of life and controls your destiny. The Lord is the one who gave us our breath control. Mm-hmm. You have not done so.
Yeah.
Was he trying to appease Daniel by telling him those things?
Maybe.
It makes me think of when John the Baptist was beheaded. You know, the king had said, I'll give you whatever you want in front of all these people at the party. And she says, give me the head of John the Baptist. Well, he has to do it because he's in front of all these people. So he's got to save face and do what he said that he was going to do.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. You know, here's Daniel. He's wagged his finger or pointed his finger at him and used the word you and your and yourself over and over and over again. What he should have done, Belshazzar, is fallen to his knees, right? He should have confessed his sin. He should have honored the God of the universe, the one who's he was mocking previously. He should have responded rightly to Daniel's indictment, his pronouncement against him. But he's got 1,000 people here staring at him, and all the wise men right around him. And what does he do? He's got to get the attention off him at this point. The party was with him at the center of it. Everybody's reveling. Everybody's looking at him hold up these goblets and having him drink from his wives and his concubines, and you know, and the whole attention's on him. And now the whole room is quiet because of this heavenly hand writing on the wall. All the eyes, all the ears, everybody's focused on him. And now he's been pointed to by Daniel saying, you, and you've not done this, and you've not humbled yourself, and you've not honored God. You've been prideful and arrogant. You've been weighed and numbered, and you're everything is, everybody's looking at him. What is the king going to do? So what he does is he says, okay, I'm going to get the attention off me. Let's put it on Daniel. We'll put the gold necklace around him. We'll clothe him in purple. We'll make him the 3rd king. Everybody's probably excited. You know, he got this. Look at him. He's this Jewish exile. And now he's the number 3 king. And he's able to do this. He's able to explain it all out here. It's diverting the attention off of Belshazzar's pronouncement, his indictment against him about his arrogance and his pride and his lack of humility and not honoring God. And so
he gives him an escape clause in verse 21 when he talks about Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven away from people and given the mind of an animal. He
He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like the ox, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven. And here comes the key out. Until he acknowledged that the Most High God is sovereign over all nations on earth and sets over them anyone he wishes. When Nebuchadnezzar acknowledged that, all the bad went off of him, and it's like, here's your little golden ticket. If you'll acknowledge that God is sovereign, I think that would be about the only way that Belshazzar could redeem himself. Mm-hmm. And yet he chooses not to do that. Mm-hmm. He doesn't humble himself the way Nebuchadnezzar did.
Definitely.
Maybe he thought he had time. He just had one night.
Yeah. Maybe he thought he had time.
I wonder if there's not an overflowing sense, too, through this whole story of the focus of Belshazzar. In the very beginning, the whole city, the whole people are threatened by a mighty army outside the door. And in a sense, he's saying, don't worry about them. I'm the one who's in power here. Look, come on in. Have a party. We're going to relax because I've got this all under control. And then this happens, and he turns around and says, I'm still the one that's in power. I bestow honor. Instead of honoring God, he bestows honor on a man again. Instead of on God, still being the one who's, I've got it under control. I'm the one in power.
Yeah, excellent.
And God says, right, snuff, gone.
Yeah, you don't want to get God's attention on you if you're acting like that. Yeah, he snuffed him one night. What's it say here at the end? It says, that very night. That's not just thrown in there for, you know, some space to fill up. That very night, Belshazzar, the Chaldean king, was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Historians tell us what the Medes and the Persians did is they went up north of the city where the Tigris River flows, and they diverted it. They either dammed it up or they were able to make it flow for a little while different, and so the riverbed dropped where it went underneath the city walls. Mm-hmm. And the army could come right in underneath the walls. It was probably pretty mucky and everything, but they came in and they surprised them. They were having a party while the Medes and the Persians are coming in underneath the wall. They didn't have to break down this huge wall that could take chariots two by two on across the top of it. You know, it's a humongous wall. It's no longer there, of course. But they came in underneath the city walls, and they were able to rout the city and overwhelm it and take over the capital of the whole kingdom. I wonder what the story was with Nabonidus when he found out about what went on. You know, he was off in Arabia somewhere for 10 years. But they come over, and that very night, Belshazzar, he's put to death. And now Darius the Mede receives the kingdom. Cyrus is another name for him. He comes in and he takes over. Pretty amazing. Pretty sad in many ways that the whole family, you know, if Nebuchadnezzar truly came to the Lord as an adult, the damage pretty much had been done before that time on the family. Pretty dysfunctional that they're killing off each other, assassinating each other, and you know, the relationships between, you know, the brothers and the sisters and the brother-in-law. It's pretty sad in that. But here we see that God will not be mocked. Proverbs 13:1. Let me read that for you. A wise son hears his father's instruction, but a scoffer does not listen to rebuke. A wise son hears his father's instruction. Belshazzar heard the life of his grandfather, of his father, and should have learned from it. Daniel said, you knew all these things. You should have learned from it. You should have changed your ways, because look at how God worked amazingly. And not just in one day, you know, like in chapter 3 where we saw the fiery furnace, that was all in one day's events. But here, with Nebuchadnezzar, it was a year, you know, and then 7 years before he came back, and how his kingdom was restored. This should have been a major family event that was told many times over, and I have no doubt that it wasn't. That he should have learned from that, from his father's story, from his instruction of his life. But Proverbs says a scoffer does not listen to rebuke. He didn't listen to Daniel's rebuke. Yourself in that. He was a scoffer. And what came from it? And then Galatians. I want us to focus in on Galatians for a minute here. Galatians chapter 6. Okay. Galatians chapter 6, verse 6. One who is taught the word must share all good things with the one who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever one sows, that will he also reap. The one who sows to his own flesh will be the flesh reap contempt, corruption. For the one who sows to the Spirit will from that Spirit reap eternal life. God is not mocked. And that's what happened with Belshazzar here. Is he scoffed God. He mocked God. He did not honor God. We saw at the end of chapter 4... the very end of it, it says, those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. And Nebuchadnezzar was humbled. He walked in pride. But it wasn't until he responded rightly. We don't see that same thing with Belshazzar. He diverts the attention. He doesn't respond to the indictment, the pronouncement against him. And so God doesn't take mocking lightly. He responds to Belshazzar with saying, your life, your kingdom, your rule, your reign is all numbered. It's been weighed and numbered, and now it's going to be divided up. And so the Medes and the Persians come in. Darius takes over as king on this. What do you think? Now, we've said all along that this is more than just a historical account. This is more than just Sunday school lessons for, you know, third graders. You know, and next week is probably one of the most familiar stories of all, Daniel in the Lion's Den. But what do you think we're to learn from this chapter, from this account? Why is this in Scripture? It's more than just a historical event. What are we supposed to take from this?
You can learn from the person of Daniel that in the midst of trial and persecution in his own life when he was so young, being sent to captivity in Babylon. But I bet at the time when he was sent to captivity in Babylon, his heart was full of worship. He has a strong relationship with God. And so what did he do? He did so many things. He ministered to Nebuchadnezzar, and his reputation was so big in the country, so that night the queen said, go get him. What a testimony of, and he never chickened out from talking about the Lord. He was so brave, and because the Lord strengthened with him. And I can learn from that, because we can look at our country today. Political correctness. Do we dare to share with people what a mighty God we serve? What has he done in our own lives? And be faithful to him. And be what Daniel is. So I'm just very moved and touched by the person of Daniel's, his strong relationship with the Lord all these years, from the beginning of captivity, and next week we're going to learn about the lion's den, and nothing happened. That's what God is doing to each one of us, if we are faithful to Him and be strong in Him and daily using His Word as a bread of our life. You know?
It's my responsibility to share with my kids and my grandkids to not only know the facts of the story, but what God has done in my life. And to be able to share with them, don't do what I have done. Don't, you know, because they may look at it and say, oh, this is what happened. You know, the king Nebuchadnezzar was restored. But do they know why he was restored? And do they know what God has done in my life? And why I am who I am today. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's very important that we share with generations down to come.
Yeah.
I think, too, the lesson about doing the will of God and honoring God, as you started us out with this morning, you know, by the time you see the handwriting on the wall, it's probably too late.
Yeah.
So often. I have stumbled and said, Lord, what am I supposed to do? What's your will? And He's already shown me this much. One man finally looked at me and said, do what you know. Do that much. Obey that much. And He'll show you more. Don't, oh, I want to know for sure that this is God's plan. And maybe I should just wait. No, there's always, God has already revealed. Do what He has already revealed.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the key of Daniel's talking to Belshazzar. He says, in all your ways you have not honored God. Verse 23. You know, and I have to ask the question, okay, is Daniel pointing at me as well? In all my ways am I honoring God? I'd like to think so, but if I get pretty reflective and a little bit introspective, I have to say, kind of like what Tyson said this morning, there's little things. Maybe we don't have this big statue, Dagon, but there's little cupboard ones, you know, that I probably have in my life. I know I have in my life. Yeah. But, you know, does...
If we didn't, we wouldn't need Jesus.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Even now, though.
Right.
What else? What else we learn from this? Excellent comments.
God is God. We may not believe it, or we may not act like it as a nation or as a people, but He's God, and it doesn't change who He is, even though we're leaving this or leading a sinful life. And I just look where the country is, and it just disappoints me so much. And yet God is God. And that's, whether you believe it or not, that's what the truth is.
He's a righteous God who commands to be honored.
I find it really unique how what can now be because of what he because what he did at the end of the last chapter. How I find it funny how now this other Ken was just defiant, and God will only take so much defiance on a nation or on a kin or whoever before He came down on us. I just find it really interesting how He came down like smack right now.
Yeah, and this isn't just reserved to, you know, the Babylonians. It's, you know, that's the book of Judges. You know, it's Judges. There's a whole series of these guys that come along, and God uses that person to point the finger and say, you against Israel. And then they respond. And then a short while later, they go back to their old ways, their old gods. It's Baal and Asherah. Wooden idols that they use, and they go through this repeated cycle over and over. That's the whole book of Judges in that. So it's not just against the Babylonians, but it's also against Israel. And I have to say, against me too. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very good comments. Any last minute things, other things that you've learned? What do we learn from this?
I was just thinking, Daniel, was in Babylon for 70 years.
Yeah, more.
Or more. And then he was faithful to the Lord the entire time. He didn't say, well, maybe I shouldn't say this thing. Maybe I should just, you know, not just keep my mouth shut and then don't do all these things and flowing with the culture. He never did. He was so faithful to God. No matter what the culture changes and so different from his own, he was so faithful to God.
Yeah. You know, before I make my final comments, anybody else?
I would like to say that God is unpredictable. With King David, baby, as I call it, because I cannot pronounce his name.
King David.
He gave him an opportunity to humble him. He responded. He could have done the same thing with Belshazzar. He could have humbled him, given an opportunity to. He chose not to. With the judges, he dealt with these people up and down, as you say. Even between Malachi and Jesus for 400 years, he doesn't say anything. So, to me, from the beginning of Scripture to the end, we cannot bother him in terms of saying God is going to do this and that. He's still unpredictable. So, in my life, I have to be ready to be held accountable at any given time. Because I don't know what I'm going to be asked.
Yeah. We don't know what God's going to ask of us. You know, sometimes in Christianity we say, come to Jesus and all your problems will be solved. Life will be good. Everything will be, all your problems will be dealt with. And we hear that, you know, and we sometimes even think that, or we even wish that to be true for us, right? And we look at the amazing life that Daniel had. He's now been promoted once again. Every end of every chapter, Daniel's promoted further and further and further. Now he's number 3. And like it was said, over here, number 2. He'll be soon to be number 2. But the life that Daniel had, I imagine, if you were to ask him as a teenager, what would you hope out of life? What were your plans that you'd love to see happen? It didn't equate to, like, I want to live in Babylon for the rest of my life. That probably wasn't, you know, on his list of, you know, what would a wonderful life be if I was a follower of Jesus or a follower of God. I'm going to get all these wonderful things. He had a life that was given him that was pretty hard. And it oftentimes involved, you know, the threats on his life. You know, the guard was at the door in chapter number 2. His friends, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, just like they got thrown in a fiery furnace. That doesn't seem too like, hey, I'm following God and he throws me in a furnace. That doesn't seem too exciting, too wonderful. You know, and then we saw, you know, Daniel, if you don't bow down, you know, that kind of thing, the fiery furnace. And now, you know, this chapter, there's no threat on Daniel's life. Wait till next week. It ratchets it up one more time. But, you know, Daniel's called on to give testimony to the God of the universe and to say some pretty hard things to some pretty important people. You know, there's 1,000 people standing here or sitting here looking at him. What is he going to say? I mean, I shy away from that. You know, I don't like the response of people at times to give. And this is a hard time. When it's the easy times, even, that makes it hard to do. But here's Daniel. He's in his 70s at this point. You know, from chapter 1 to chapter 5 now, all these years, he's seen God do some amazing things. But also, we're going to see here in chapter 6, I think, why Daniel is who he is. And then in chapter 9, which will be our last week together, we'll see it even more. But Daniel's walk with the Lord was a day in, day out thing. It wasn't just these big moments every 20 years. It was a day in and day out thing. So when the big moments came, he responded rightly. And so there's a lot to learn from this chapter, and I'd encourage you to think about it, maybe read it again. We buzzed through it pretty quickly. To read about it again, and think about it again, and think, what do I learn from this? How is God challenging me from this? Let me close in prayer. Father, indictment was with a pointed finger was at Belshazzar. But I have to put my own name in there at times, thinking, what have I done that doesn't honor you? Have I taken away any of your glory and praise that should be rightly yours? Father, I pray that for each of us, that if there are things, even small things, that we should humble ourselves before you, that we should walk away from our pride, turn away from that, to honor you in all that we do and say, that you would cause us to reflect on that and to make a right choice, to turn away from our own self-sufficiency and self-accomplishment and self-pride, and to give you the glory and the honor. Father, to give you the glory and honor is to acknowledge who you are and all that you've done. You've done amazing things in each of our lives, and you wish to do more as we follow wholeheartedly after you. Father, I pray that these lessons from Daniel would be more than just children's stories to us, but would be very much challenging us to have a life of character and to not compromise. In Christ's name I pray.